Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the decision or non-decision by Facebook to maintain its ban against Donald Trump on its platform, which was enacted on January the 7th, the day after the attack on the Capitol that Trump instigated. Michael Hiltzik, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, who writes the twice-weekly Golden State column and is the author of Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America, joins us. We'll discuss his latest column at the Los Angeles Times, Facebook's non-decision on banning Trump does no one any good, and how Zuckerberg punted in handing the decision to ban Trump to the Facebook Oversight Board, which in turn upheld the ban, but punted on the most important decision to make the ban temporary or permanent, as is the case with Twitter's banning of Trump. With Facebook unwilling to take responsibility for the enormous power it has as the main conduit of news and information, its efforts at content moderation are at best cosmetic, since Trump is now leading a movement based on lies to overturn a democratic election, and only a concerted defense of facts and truth can save American democracy from further ruination from this wannabe dictator. Then, with the G7 foreign ministers meeting in London, committing their collective capabilities to fight disinformation from Russia and China and strengthen ties to its so-called rapid response mechanism to rebut lies and propaganda, we will speak with a specialist on Russian disinformation, propaganda, and information warfare, Natalie Manieva-Rice, Research Associate at the Center for Information and Communication Studies at the University of Tennessee. We will also assess the military standoff between Russia and Ukraine, where Secretary of State Blinken has a day of meetings in Kiev on Thursday. Then finally, we will speak with Ben Burgess, a philosophy instructor at Georgia State University and a columnist for Jacobin Magazine, who is the co-host of the Dead Pundits Society podcast. He joins us to discuss his new book just out, Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, a critique of the contemporary left, and we will examine how the Republicans are trying to position themselves as the party of the working class, which is an indication of how the American left needs to get its act together. And joining us now is Michael Hiltzik, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing the corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. His books include Colossus, Hoover Dam and the Making of the American Century, The New Deal, A Modern History, and Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook's non-decision on banning Trump does no one any good. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hiltzik.
Well, it's good to be back with you, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael. And Facebook's board, which is, what, 20 people? Well, first of all, it looks as if Zuckerberg punted to the board because he didn't want to make a decision about banning Trump, and the board banned him, and they've extended the ban, but it's open-ended. So what's your sense of whether this is any kind of victory? Because Donald Trump is actually more pernicious than ever because he's hoisted the big lie, which has now become the kind of loyalty test for the GOP, which he controls. And they apparently, this party, the Republican Party, apparently is prepared to lie and cheat its way back into power. And they may well come back into power. And he may well come back into power in 2024. And I think, without being hyperbolic, that could be the end of American democracy. So, or the beginning of the end of American democracy. So it would seem to me that it's an imperative to stop this man from having any more of a megaphone than he has. What he's got so far is working out pretty well for him, isn't it?
Well, I don't know about that. You know, he's been thrown off Twitter permanently, at least that's what Twitter says. This oversight board basically upheld the existing ban on him and instructed Facebook management to basically come back with some sort of firm ruling themselves within 6 months about whether to continue the ban on Trump. So it's in place now. What happens in 6 months is another question. But I think, although, you know, the Republican brain trust, such as it is, seems to have affiliated itself with Trump, the fact is that his being banned from these key social media platforms has sort of muted his influence over everybody else. You know, the Republicans are on their way to making themselves irrelevant, as they long have been in California, if the only test of Republicanism is, you know, are you with Trump? Do you, you know, are you buying into this big lie that, you know, he won the election, but, you know, didn't become president? Then I just don't see that as being a key to Republican survival. You know, Trump lost the election. He lost it by, I can't remember the exact, five million or seven million votes.
7 million, yeah.
Yeah, 7 million votes. We don't hear from him very much, if at all, anymore. We just see the sycophants in the GOP going down and praising him, or, you know, and trying to eject members of their own party who are trying to tell the truth. So there's that. I mean, I think it really is critical that he be kept off these public social media platforms. But you know, I think there's another important thing here, which is, what was this oversight board, and did it do its job, and did it fulfill everybody's positive expectations or what? And I think the answer to that is that it really botched the job. You know, Zuckerberg punted the decision on whether to keep to admit Trump back to Facebook to this board, and they basically punted it back to him. The question is, you know, what are they good for if they couldn't take a firm stand, a lasting stand, on really the most critical question about Facebook's influence over the rest of us through Donald Trump? They didn't. They basically said, well, you know, we're going to make a policy recommendation that Facebook think about this more for the next 6 months. And the board's decision, which was issued Wednesday, which basically, you know, basically says there was a minority of our membership, and it was just 19 of the 20 existing members who voted. A minority said he should only be allowed back if he makes a public confession that he's wrong and apologizes for his role in the January 6th insurrection. And we know that's not going to happen. But once again, that was a minority view. The majority view was, well, you know, let's have Zuckerberg make a decision. So it really, you know, look, when Zuckerberg set this thing up, everybody said it's going to be, the worst thing that can happen is if it shows itself to be toothless and not really independent of management. And I think that's exactly what happened.
And of course, the board is called the Facebook Oversight Board, the acronym being FOB. It does seem like they've fobbed it off. But again, I'm speaking with Michael Hiltzik, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times, who received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry. He currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And his books include The New Deal of Modern History and Iron Empires, Robber Barons, Railroads, and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook's Non-Decision on Banning Trump Does No One Any Good. But the ban happened on January the 6th because of Trump's incitement of the storming of the Capitol. And it would seem to me that what you just told us about the percentages on the board is somewhat alarming, that the majority couldn't make a decision and punted it back to Zuckerberg. But surely, could you make Trump's getting back on Facebook conditional to giving up the stop the steal lie. And when you say that it's not going to work for them, this strategy, what about all of the voter suppression that's going on? I mean, in Texas now, they picked up a bunch of seats because of the census. They'll probably win the House before one vote is cast, unless there's a non-traditional sweep by the Democrats, which doesn't usually happen in midterms.
Well, that's a different, that's a good question, and we don't really know. You know, we don't know how many of these laws are going to be passed, and we don't know what impact they're going to have. I mean, there's always a way. In fact, Stacey Abrams in Georgia showed that when, you know, the Georgia Republicans and Georgia whites try to suppress black votes, there's a way to use that against them in sort of this sort of electoral judo. You know, you can use it to actually get black voters out in greater force. And they did elect, after all, two Democratic U.S. senators. But, you know, that's different from the question that you know, we were confronting today with Facebook. Facebook is certainly within its legal rights to say, we're not going to let Trump back on our platform unless he meets certain standards, and it can dictate what the standards are. The problem here was that Facebook management basically passed the buck to this body that Facebook management created, and they passed the buck back. I think the oversight board, if the oversight board said, we recommend that Trump not be permitted back on the platform, then I don't see how Facebook could have said, well, we're not going to comply with that recommendation. They committed themselves to treating the oversight board's decisions seriously. They can't just simply say, well, we didn't really mean it, or we don't agree. They've got to do it, but the oversight board didn't do that. And I think one of the points I made is that we all know why you create committees. You create committees and you try to make them as big as you can, because that's where hard decisions go to die. You don't want a clear decision out of a committee, or you would just make the decision yourself. And here, you know, this is a group of 20 people. One American activist came on the board just, you know, a week or two ago, so she didn't participate in this decision. So that leaves 19. And they're all perfectly creditable individuals. They're professors, law professors, they're human rights advocates. They're, you know, former government officials from all over the world. But, you know, from if you look at who they are, you see that these are, you know, a large number of these people didn't actually have a career in which they had to take hard decisions in specific cases. They were all making policy, and you can make policy, and then you leave it up to somebody else to implement. And here's a case where this board of, you know, policymakers sort of thought about a policy and set forth standards for that policy, but are leaving it back to Facebook to implement it. And you're not getting anywhere with that. You know, they took two steps forward and then two steps back, and we're back where we started.
But inherent in this situation seems to be the fact that Facebook doesn't want to admit how enormously powerful it is. I mean, I'm sure Zuckerberg and company are perfectly happy to be as financially successful as they are, but they've always acted like the piano player in the whorehouse, that they're not responsible for what goes out over their platform. And they've been sort of forced into what they call content moderation after a lot of lobbying. And they've set up this board, as you say, the reason you create boards is for tough decisions to die. So is that what's going on, though, as a subtext here?
Yeah, the concern that everybody had when Facebook first set this thing up was that it would be sort of a smokescreen. And I think Facebook is well aware and has acknowledged one way or another that it knows how powerful it is. And it set up this board, to give it a veneer of oversight from the outside, a veneer of independence. And yet, this was really the first major decision that this board has made, certainly the first one of any interest to members of the public, and it blew it. You know, it said we're not going to make this decision. And if you're not going to make this decision, the decision that, you know, this important decision about whether the insurrectionist in chief should have a right to spout his poison and his malevolence and his noxiousness on our platform, if you're not going to take a stand, you know, and in a way that makes it enforceable, then who cares about you? You know, what's really happening? What's really happening is that Facebook has an interest in, you know, noxious content, because that's what brings eyeballs to the platform in great number. And it's not, you know, look, Mark Zuckerberg could take a stand by himself. He controls the company. He could say, I'm never letting Trump back on.
As the Twitter guy, right? Dorsey did that, right?
Well, Twitter, Dorsey doesn't have the same degree of control over Twitter, but the Twitter board certainly did it.
Right.
You know, they within their rights. They don't have to let anybody on, and they can eject anybody they want for any reason they want. Facebook, you know, has sort of swanked around like it's different and it's responsible and it's going to outsource this really difficult decision, which, you know, to most of us isn't difficult at all. I mean, it's clear that Trump is dangerous to have anywhere, that he's got a megaphone. So, but, you know, Zuckerberg's got unassailable control over everything about Facebook. You know, he's got, you know, a supermajority of votes among shareholders. He's, you know, nobody challenges him. He could have done this. He outsourced it to this group of 20, you know, good people, and basically did it in a way that didn't require them to actually make a decision. And so they didn't make a decision.
But just in the last few minutes, Michael Hiltzik, from my point of view, it's pretty sad that we're counting on a guy like Mark Zuckerberg to save American democracy, because I believe we are really hanging by a thread here. If you may not think that the Republicans could win in 2022 and 2024, but the fact of the matter is that Trump completely controls the GOP. They're going to purge Liz Cheney, because what did Liz Cheney do? She said that Trump did not win the election, and he was responsible for the January 6th storming of the Capitol. That's heresy. I mean, it's become a sort of Stalinist party where the truth tellers get purged and the rest of them go in lockstep behind the chairman, the Fuhrer, the dear leader. And they're marching us all to the abyss. So there has to be a reason why McCarthy and all of these Republicans are doing what they're doing. And the explanation is, oh, it's because of the base. Well, the base must be significant. And surely the only chance we have in this divided country is to somehow get through this wall of disinformation to let the base know that the earth is not flat, it's round, and that Trump did not win, and that he's responsible for the worst attack on American democracy, or in fact, you know, the worst attack in American history since the British burned the White House in 1814.
Well, I agree with basically everything you said. I would point out that what's bad about this particular decision for Facebook is that Facebook was hoping to quell the concerns about the power that it exercises over public discourse, and this decision has done exactly the opposite. It's shown that Facebook cannot regulate itself. So, you know, and yes, it's true that, you know, that the Republican Party is marching in lockstep or goose step to Trump, but the evidence is that people are leaving the Republican Party. The base is shrinking all the time because of this. So, you know, I don't want to sound like a Pollyanna, because anything can happen. And, you know, certainly, you know, in the fullness of time, I could be proven completely wrong. But you know, from what I can see in terms of the electoral numbers, the only thing that the Republicans have going for them is this attempt to suppress non-Republican votes and to gerrymander the district. And I think that will work on the margins, especially if there's no coordinated response from Democrats and independents. But I think we are seeing more of a response from Democrats and independents. Look, the Republican Party at this point is a shrinking regional body that has nothing to offer Americans except empty rhetoric and gerrymandering and voter suppression. And I think there's a real limit to how much that'll work. And we see it, if we want to look at California as sort of a bellwether, the Republican Party here is essentially out of business. It hasn't had a statewide officer. There hasn't been a Republican statewide official since Arnold Schwarzenegger, who even Republicans weren't quite sure was a Republican. Their registration, voter registration in California is 2-1 Democratic, which is as high as it's ever been. And that's because the Republicans have shown that they have no policies of any value and no willingness to change to meet what the voters want. And I think we're beginning to see that nationwide.
Right. But of course, the California Republicans still up to mischief. They can cause damage, which they are doing with this recall.
They're causing
mischief.
They've
got this recall,
certainly, certainly the recall and, the smart money. And once again, you never want to really predict how an election is going to go because anything can happen. But it doesn't look like this is going to go the Republicans' way. And look, if the recall fails, then where's the Republican Party of California? It tried to basically steal the governorship, and if it fails, it's not going to look any better. I mean, and look at the Republican bench in California. I mean, you've got Caitlyn Jenner, who's running as a transgender advocate, but who actually has affiliated herself with the enemies of transgender inclusiveness. And you've got this guy, a failed gubernatorial candidate who's been driving around with a live bear in his RV, for making some point that I don't even comprehend. So it's not like, the average Californian is going to look at this and say, well, I may not like everything that Gavin Newsom, our Democratic governor, has done, but I don't really see how the Republicans can claim to do any better.
Well, Michael Hiltzik, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
All right. Happy to do it.
Thanks a lot. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hiltzik, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and columnist at the Los Angeles Times. He received the 1999 Pulitzer Prize for articles exposing corruption in the entertainment industry, and he currently writes the twice-weekly column Golden State, covering business and economic issues relevant to life in California. And he's the author of The New Deal in Modern History and Iron Empires, Robert Barron's Railroads and the Making of Modern America. And his latest column at the Los Angeles Times is Facebook's non-decision on banning Trump does no one any good. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how the G7 foreign ministers meeting in London committed their collective capabilities to fight disinformation from Russia and China through their so-called rapid response mechanism. 100%. Don't get error. 100%. Protect your eyes. Protect yourself from digital decay.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan. Prophecy, our destiny, we will not hide. When the sun comes up, it will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now, Natalie Menieva-Rice, who is a research associate at the Center for Information and Communication Studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where she studies the effectiveness of Russian propaganda and disinformation in the former Soviet countries of Ukraine, Belarus, and Georgia. Her research focuses on the use of digital and social media disinformation, propaganda, and other information warfare techniques used by state actors targeting the U.S. and foreign audiences. And she also studies Russian foreign policy, its influence campaigns, and the resulting impacts on global security. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natalie Menieva-Rice.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you for having me on the show.
Well, thanks for joining me, Natalie. And the G7 foreign ministers have been meeting in London. The Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, is now in Kiev, where he'll have meetings tomorrow, Thursday. Ahead of him, of course, they sent number three person in the State Department, Victoria Nuland, who is extremely unpopular with Putin's and his propaganda machine. But let's touch on what seemed to have come out of the Group of Seven meeting in London, and that is that they have formed some kind of an organization to basically combat or rebut disinformation, and it's called the Rapid Response Mechanism. So is this likely to work, the idea that the wealthiest nations are going to work together with other organizations like NATO, etc., to be able to combat misinformation coming from both China and Russia?
Well, that is very good news. It's wonderful to hear that the governments and international organizations are paying more attention trying to limit foreign influence, especially from authoritarian countries like China and Russia. But something that came out of the research that we do at the University of Tennessee, and again, we have a project when we're studying the effectiveness of the Russian propaganda campaigns in three former Soviet Union countries. One of the interesting results that comes out of studies that is very relevant to this discussion is the fact that based on our media monitoring and based on the public opinion polls that we're conducting in the countries, we're finding out a very interesting thing, that local pro-Russian mass media, journalists, bloggers, politicians, different influencers in those countries are actually much more stronger anti-American and anti-Western compared to their Russian counterparts. So Russia is supporting a whole network of these media organizations and journalists and other influencers to push their message inside of those countries. And we're finding out from doing surveys and asking people what their opinion are about different political issues and asking about the resource of information, that those local pro-Russian actors are much more effective in pushing anti-American and anti-Western messages than actual Russian TV, which is very important that they're using these local people to push their messages. And that makes the efforts to counter and stop and limit foreign influence in a very, very difficult task. And one great example that just came out of Ukraine in terms of how difficult it is to effectively limit influence of Russia or other authoritarian countries was the effort by the Ukrainian government in February this year. They have shut down three Ukrainian TV channels that were very popular. And those three TV channels were known to promote pro-Russian narratives, and they were owned by this pro-Russian oligarch. So after the Ukrainian government has banned those three TV channels, the public opinion response was absolutely disastrous for the Ukrainian government, because Ukrainians thought that their freedom of speech and their freedom of press is being abridged. They absolutely disliked the opinion of their country, who said, we can censure our local mass media. And so this example of how the efforts of governments to limit foreign influence can backfire, this is a really good case study to consider when governments are thinking of how to deal with the problem of foreign influence.
So what can this new mechanism, the rapid response mechanism, do in regard to what you've just told us? It sounds like what Vladimir Zelensky's done there has backfired in trying to stop Russian propaganda. He's actually seems as though, you know, as you say, it's backfired.
It has to be more complicated response than just shutting media organizations down, especially if you're talking about local media, who people feel that if you're trying to go after these media organizations, you're going after their freedom of speech. So the efforts to influence, to counter influence of Russian or Chinese or whatever authoritarian states has to be much more complicated. But there are good lessons that we can learn from the countries in Europe and some of the former Soviet states in terms of how do you counter Russian influence. For example, one of the very successful things that the Baltic countries are doing, including Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, they have hourly TV shows every week when they are talking about disinformation stories that are coming out of Russian media, and they're debunking those stories prime time. And that seems to have a very good effect on countering Russian influence.
So we have that problem here, of course. Russian misinformation is slipping into our media, and it did have an effect in 2016 in helping elect Trump, and it persists. And when you say that the most effective assets that Russian misinformation has is pro-Russian people in these former Soviet states, does that also extend to Western Europe and the United States?
Well, I am not a specialist in American politics or European policy per se. We're just looking at the data that is coming from those countries in Eastern Europe. But again, based on the results of our research, definitely local mass media had a much stronger effect. And you can just say from general knowledge that, for example, the popularity of RT, that is headquarters in London, and with the production value that they have, and with employing journalists with beautiful pronunciation and making it seem like a domestic British media, that definitely can signal to us that Russia is using the same strategy in other countries.
But the US and the British don't have the equivalent of RT that's played in Russia, right? Or China, for that matter.
Absolutely. Of course, we still have the Radio Liberty and Radio Free Europe and some other media organizations supported by the West. But because Russian society is so much more restrictive in terms of freedom of the press and freedom of the speech, the Russian government can very successfully undermine those sources or even shut out their audiences from those media sources.
And again, I'm speaking with Natalie Maneeva-Rice, who's a research associate at the Center for Information and Communication Studies at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, where she studies the effectiveness of Russian propaganda and disinformation in the former Soviet countries of Ukraine, Belarus, and Georgia. Her research focuses on the use of digital and social media, disinformation, propaganda, and other information warfare techniques used by state actors targeting the U.S. and foreign audiences. And she also studies Russian foreign policy, its influence campaigns, and the resulting impacts on global security. So what do you know then, Natalie? Because we're all sort of looking into the tea leaves here, trying to figure out what Putin's moves have been about on the Ukrainian border, massing over 100,000 troops and then pulling them back but leaving their equipment on the border. And some analysts, military analysts, say that a military attack on Ukraine wouldn't happen until later in May when the ground is dry. I don't know where we stand. As I mentioned earlier, Secretary of State Blinken is in Kiev. He'll have meetings tomorrow, Thursday. The number three person in the State Department, Victoria Nuland, is there meeting with Ukrainian officials, and she's deeply unpopular with Putin and with Russian media that Putin controls. So what's your reading on, well, first of all, what are the Russian people hearing about what's going on with these troop deployments? What's Putin's spin on what he's doing? And, you know, as I say, it looked very aggressive initially, and now they've pulled back, but the equipment's been left behind. So it's hard to follow what's going on. So any kind of indications that you have got from Russian media that might illuminate what is happening here?
Ian, that is a very good question that you're asking. And there is a really good point in looking and seeing what Kremlin is saying and what the Kremlin mouthpieces on Russian TV are saying about any particular situation, especially in terms of military escalation. Because if we look back at 2014, right before Crimea was annexed by Russia, the Russian media for several months has escalated this very strong anti-Ukrainian campaign. And if you would be reading statements by the public officials, but also listen to talking heads on Russian television, you would see a very drastic change in the rhetoric when they started addressing not just that they're trying to protect Russians in Ukraine, because there was a very small number of actual Russians, Russian nationals in Ukraine, but when they switched the rhetoric and they started saying that the goal of the Russian Federation in Ukraine is to protect the Russian speakers, that change of rhetoric was a very good red flag to possible escalation from the side of Russia. And as we saw in Crimea, that is exactly what happened. And unfortunately, we see some of those red flags indications coming out of the Kremlin propaganda machine today as well, not just from statements from public officials, but also from hosts of TV shows and those MIF talking heads that are expressing Kremlin's position. And in the past month, there has been a couple of things that started being said repeatedly. One of those things is because we know there was an escalation there on the front between Eastern Ukraine and the Ukrainian army, and the way the Russian media was portraying them, they were saying that it is the Ukrainian aggression against their own people. It is the Ukrainian army who's using weaponry against civilians in Russia, in the Russian-controlled territories. So they definitely started saying that it's Ukraine to blame. We had nothing to do with it. And some of the other things in how they're talking about it is indicating that there is a potential military aftermath. And why is it important to look at what the Russian TV and the Kremlin propaganda machine is saying about anything? Is that before they commit themselves to any kind of serious foreign policy action, including military action, they have to prepare the Russian people. And that's why following what those talking heads are saying and how the Russian media is covering is a very good indication of what's to come.
So we have a pattern, though, of course, when Putin feels he needs a boost in his popularity, he gets involved in a foreign action. And that, of course, was what happened with Crimea. That was incredibly popular in Russia. So what kind of indications are there about a move, particularly a military move, against Ukraine, which would involve Russian casualties? I know that the Russians and their surrogates who've died so far in this war, which has cost about 13,000 lives, I believe, they are buried in secret, and the families are sworn to secrecy by the FSB, the successor agency of the KGB. But if there was a war, there'd be a lot of body bags. So I don't know how they could cover that up. And my understanding is that the Russian people, you know, don't have always thought of the Ukrainian people as their sort of brothers and sisters. But I believe that since Putin has seized Ukraine and started this low-grade war on the border, the Ukrainian people have turned against Russia. So give us a sense of the public opinion on both sides.
Sure, thank you. And it is a pretty complicated dynamic, and I'm very glad that you brought up this pattern that we see in Russian foreign policy, which dominates the decision-making in terms of Kremlin actions abroad for decades by now. Because every single time when Putin's support domestically within his own population is decreasing, his response is to come up with some kind of aggressive foreign policy action that would make him look victorious, that would make his population support him again. And we see from public opinion polls that this strategy works brilliantly for him. The same thing happened before 2008 conflict with Georgia, when support and the willingness for people to vote for Putin was going down. After this brief war that he had with Georgia, when he took almost 20% of the Georgian territory, his ratings skyrocketed. And he has learned this lesson. And you're absolutely right that the same story happened in Crimea. When before he invaded Ukraine, his popularity was dwindling. After that, he was seen as this victorious leader who's collecting real Russian lands from the perspective of the Russian population. And there definitely is some of that dynamic going on right now. And let me tell you, first of all, what we know about Russian public opinion right now. Vladimir Putin is not in a very good place right now in terms of support of his own people. He introduced a very unpopular pension reform in 2018 that has made his rating and his support among all groups of population drop significantly. And in the past 2 years, his approval rating has been at about 64-65%. At the same time, when people were asked, and these are the results of the public opinion polls by the Levada Center I'm talking to you about, which is the only one independent pollster in Russia that asks questions about sociopolitical issues. So according to their polls, in February of this year, only 40% of the voters said they would vote again for President Putin if the election would be taking place next week. So this 40% of Russians that are willing to support him, that is very, very troublesome information for Vladimir Putin. Another interesting statistic that comes out of the same poll is that when you're looking at young people in Russia, 18 to 24-year-olds, if last year, the same time around February, 36% of them supported Putin would be willing to vote for him, today it dropped to 20%. And that is very bad information for Putin, because the opinion of young people that is dropping like that about him, his support, is indicating that he might have even more troubles in the years ahead with other age populations. So definitely, from perspective of Putin, we have a domestic situation where the economy is not doing well. In the past several years, the growth of the Russian economy hasn't exceeded 1%, and the support of his own people is diminishing. So from his perspective, from the mindset of the Kremlin, initiating some kind of glorious military campaign to restore his image might be something that they're considering right now.
Well, but just in the last minute here, Natalie, a war against Ukraine is a big deal. I mean, the president, Zelensky, was on TV recently in Ukraine saying, we don't want war, but we're ready. Russia has massive forces. They pulled back, but they left their equipment behind, so it wouldn't be that hard to basically redeploy them, these forces. And they have surrounded Ukraine now. They've even got air bases now in Belarus to the north, and massive armor on the northeast. And they got their surrogates in the Donbass, and they've got naval assets on the Black Sea. So I don't see how a war with Ukraine could actually be surgical, swift, get rid of the Ukrainian government, reinstall a Russian puppet, and be as successful as a propaganda move for Putin as Crimea was. This is not Crimea with a little green man. This would be a major war.
But let me give you a couple of points to consider in this regard. First of all is that the Russian media and Russian propaganda machine, which is very effective in terms of influence and public opinion of Russians themselves, they can do it. If before the war in Ukraine, according to polls, Ukraine was number one or number two in terms of what are the most friendliest nations, when the Russian people were asked, they said Ukraine. After the war, and after this very, very intense propaganda campaign for 3 months on Russian television that was portraying Ukrainian government as fascist, as nationalistic, as aggressive, as oppressing Russian speakers, the polls were showing that Ukraine was popping up as number one in terms of what is our main enemy. So yes, in just a couple of months, they were able to change the mind of the Russian people that significantly. Now, your question about what would be the impact of all-out war, I'm not quite sure that they would have to have all-out war to begin with. Because, you know, a significant portion of the eastern Ukraine right now is controlled by the pro-Russian militia. And in those areas, including some other areas of eastern Ukraine, support for Vladimir Putin and for probable unification with Russia and for the Russian cause has actually been increasing. First of all, because they're receiving significant economic support and economic help from Russia. And second of all, because there were policies conducted by the Ukrainian government of Zelensky that were incredibly unpopular among the Russian speakers, and especially people in eastern Ukraine. For example, they have passed a law in 2019, it was called Law About the Language, that made Ukrainian language an official language of the country and has pretty much banned the use of Russian language in television, in official communications, in almost all of the public sphere. Well, at the same time, 35% of Ukrainians, according to polls, say that their native language is Russian. So when you have a third of a population who are mostly living in those areas in eastern Ukraine, and you're banning the language that is native for them, that is viewed in a very, very bad way. So there is still significant support, and it's growing among those people in eastern Ukraine. So I'm not sure that in order to control those territories, Russia would have to go with a full-out war, because they will have very significant support of the local population.
Well, Natalie Menayeva-Rice, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian. I appreciate it.
And again, I've been speaking with Natalie Menayeva-Rice, who's a research associate at the Center for Information and Communication Studies at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville, where she studies the effectiveness of Russian propaganda and disinformation in the former Soviet countries of Ukraine, Belarus, and Georgia. Her research focuses on the use of digital and social media disinformation, propaganda, and other information warfare techniques used by state actors targeting the U.S. and foreign audiences. And she also studies Russian foreign policy, its influence campaigns, and the resulting impacts on global security. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Ben Burgess, columnist with Jacobin Magazine, about his new book just out, Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, A Critique of the Contemporary Left. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ben Burgess, a philosophy instructor at Georgia State University Perimeter College and a columnist for Jacobin Magazine and Arc Digital Media, and the co-host of the Dead Pundit Society podcast. He's also does a regular segment on the late Michael Brooks show called The Debunk, and is the author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. And his latest book just out is Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, A Critique of the Contemporary Left. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ben Burgess.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And a critique of the contemporary left, if you could expand that into a critique of the Democratic Party, as much as that is a left-wing party, certainly compared to other social democracies, it's pretty centrist, but still... What I find amazing that's happening in this country now is that the Republican Party is angling to become the party of the American working class. And very recently, there was a memo prepared by Representative Jim Banks, a Republican of Indiana. It was entitled Cementing the GOP as the Working Class Party. And basically, it says, you know, let's go after Wall Street, let's go after corporations. And we are becoming, thanks to Trump, a working class party, and we can become a majority working class party. So what does that say about the American left?
Nothing good. I mean, the really striking thing about this is that when the GOP tries to position itself this way, it's complete nonsense in terms of their policy positions that all they really, you know, mean by working class party is a matter of cultural, you know, cultural performance and trying to angle for, you know, for votes. When really, I mean, none of these people, I mean, even the Republicans were often touted as populists, your Steve Bannons, your Tucker Carlsons, none of them support Medicare for all. None of them support a $15 minimum wage, et cetera. Their actual positions are very much pro 1%, but I think the part of the way that they get away with this is because of the relative ineffectualness of the part of the Democratic Party that I would like to win. You know, the wing that I would identify with, the Bernie Sanders wing, for example. And I think that if you look at some of the ways that oftentimes the left in the United States self-sabotages, it's pretty remarkable. So one small example from last year would be when the comedian and podcaster Joe Rogan endorsed Bernie Sanders, and there was all kinds of pushback from people saying, oh, this is terrible that, you know, Bernie Sanders accepted and touted the endorsement of this problematic person, Joe Rogan, even though nothing, you know, it's not like there had been some sort of process of negotiation where he'd given something up in exchange for the endorsement. Oh, we're not going to, you know, fund trans people's medical needs anymore or something. But merely, you know, being supported by somebody who didn't line up perfectly, who had some problematic views, maybe in some areas, was still seen as a major problem. And granted, a lot of that was ginned up by bad faith actors, supporters of other candidates. But some of it was self-inflicted. I saw more than a few people with that Democratic Socialist red rose emoji in their Twitter handles going along with this and saying, oh, no, this is really bad. You should not have accepted the endorsement of problematic Joe Rogan. And I saw some people in left media saying the same thing. And it's a very small example, but I think it's a very telling one, because if the goal is to be supported by as many people as possible so that you win, And you can enact your program and do all the things that we say we want to do, give everybody health care, stop the wars, have, you know, more ambitious democratic socialist goals down the line, then you would think that having the most popular podcaster in the world, somebody who would not necessarily be expected to support you because he's politically eclectic, somebody with a vast audience of not very political people, would be unambiguously good news. Whereas if what you see politics as is essentially a symbolic performance of moral commitment to opposition to the various injustices of the world, then, which unfortunately can very often shade into spending all of your time questioning whether other people are really, really have the right level of moral commitment. So it's a kind of nonstop interrogation of each other's souls. Then I think that can very easily fall into this kind of self-sabotaging behavior.
And thus the title of your book, Canceling Comedians While the World Burns?
Yes, exactly. So Canceling Comedians is chosen for the opening chapter as the kind of introduction to the book, as the chapter about comedy, and for the title as a representative example of the cluster of issues that I am objecting to in the book, and is one that was chosen because it's a kind of vividly absurd example of this kind of counterproductive culture of moralistic nonsense, because who cares, you know, what comedians, think about everything. I care about, you know, maybe who Joe Rogan with his vast audience says that he's going to vote for. But comedy doesn't, you know, really have the, you know, any great political potential in my view. So I think focus on what some figure like a comedian would think is, I think, really representative of this larger set of pathologies that includes hysteria over minor political differences, that includes a tendency to kind of monitor each other and get very angry over any sort of perceived deviations, to jump from somebody maybe has a bad take to they're a bad person, and also to kind of gestures of performative radicalism that, even if, like me, you know, you have very radical long-term political goals, are just extremely unhelpful, such as glorifying past authoritarian regimes, as so many people on the online left seem to be interested for some reason in doing, or making excuses, for example, for Antifa, you know, beating people up in ways that I think are like, send the worst possible message to the vast number of people that we'd actually have to convince and win over in order to achieve any of our alleged political goals.
And again, I'm speaking with Ben Burgess, a philosophy instructor at Georgia State University Perimeter College and a columnist for Jacobin Magazine and ARC Digital Media, and the co-host of the Dead Pundits Society podcast. He's also did a regular segment on the late Michael Brooks show called The Debunk. and is the author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. And his latest book just out is Canceling Comedians While the World Burns, A Critique of the Contemporary Left. So, Ben, are you talking in the broadest sense about something that is sort of perennial, at least something that I've observed, and that is that the left would rather be righteous than effective, whereas the right doesn't give a damn about ideological inconsistencies in their arguments. They just want power.
Yeah, I think that there is definitely an element of this that is a perennial problem and a very, very long-standing problem. I do think that how severe a problem it is waxes and wanes over time. And I think that part of the reason that some of these things I'm talking about are such a problem now is because I think the left, anybody really with political goals to the left of, you know, just mainstream liberalism, has been out in sort of wandering around in the outer darkness in American politics and, you know, British politics to a great extent, you know, for a very long time, such that even people like Bernie Sanders in the U.S. or Jeremy Corbyn in the U.K., who I would regard as, you know, good, honorable social Democrats, have spent most of their lives up until the last few years when they kind of had a moment in the sun as extremely marginal backbenchers. And I think the effect of that in practice is that as people, you know, as we were often very distant from real world power, which actually got much worse in, you know, the 90s and 00s and early 10s due to the decline of the labor movement and the kind of aftershocks of the fall of capital C communism, in the sense that there is no alternative to the dominant, you know, neoliberal ideology in the world, that all of that meant that it was very hard to see the left as a serious project for changing material reality. And when you don't really have much hope of that, you know, when you think that you're not really going to, you don't have much prospect of actually winning, then it becomes very tempting to reduce politics to this kind of moral performance, to taking a stand against the many very real injustices of the world. But the problem is that when you're all you're interested in taking a stand, not actually winning, then it becomes very tempting to stop worrying about how you're going to appeal to the broad mass of the population that you'd have to win over in order to be effective. It becomes very tempting to start spending way too much time, you know, fighting with each other over over trivialities. It becomes tempting to spend way too much time sort of issuing bulls of mutual excommunication, because if all you're doing is performing moral commitment, then you end up starting to wonder, well, is everybody else really displaying the, you know, the right level of moral commitment?
Well, Ben Burgess, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
All right. Thank you so much, Ian.
And again, I mean, speak with Ben Burgess, who's a philosophy instructor at Georgia State University Perimeters College and a columnist at Jacobin Magazine and Arc Digital Media, and the co-host of the Dead Pundit Society podcast. He's also did a regular segment on the late Michael Brooks show called The Debunk, and he's the author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. And his latest book just out is Canceling Comedians While the World Burns. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. And this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
One more light goes out in America. A young girl tosses a coin in the wishing well. She hopes for a heaven, while for her there's just this hell. She gave away a life to become somebody's wife. Another wish unanswered.